Today on Pilgrim Radio's His People, Pedro Garcia on the causes of deconstruction of faith.
You know, when someone is opening up about their issues, the tendency for us is always to give our opinion, which is, oh, let me tell you, this happened to me, or I know this, or all that. And we're trying to train ourselves to bring them to the Lord, to hold our mouths, and just to bring them to the Lord. Because what can I say that is going to really, right? Like, I mean, I can be there, of course. But the first thing I should do is to bring them to the Lord. A person that is, struggling with their faith, they might need space away from the Lord for a second to just for someone to listen, so that they don't feel that they're being judged because they are doubting their faith.
Pedro Garcia next. Coming up today, Spencer Dahlke talks with former atheist Pedro Garcia, author of For Those Who Doubt, Is It Because of Jesus? For those deconstructing their faith, he wants them to ask that question, is it because of Jesus? A native of Spain, Pedro is a translator for the Bible Project and gotquestions.org.
I understand that you're a former atheist who became a Christian, and I'm curious how your journey from unbelief to belief informed your approach to writing this book.
I was born in Spain and very nominal Catholic culture. I went to a Catholic school for many years, and my experience, I'm not saying anything in general, that's not for the conversation today. My experience with Catholicism was very poor, very like not good. I actually went to school for 12 years, and I left the Catholic school without knowing that Jesus had died for my sins. So there you go. That's a summary of it. Something happened, long story, and I decided not to believe in God anymore. The problem for me, Spencer, was that when I was 12, this happened when I was 12, 13, yes. I didn't know how to distinguish between Jesus and the people who claimed to follow him. Everything was like one thing. So I just put everything together. I don't believe in this anymore. So I left the whatever faith I had at the time. And yeah, for many years was an atheist. Even though I studied music and that's what brought me to the States, I've always loved philosophy and the big questions in life. So I was really open to have those conversations all the time, but I lacked a framework of truth, you know? So when I came to the States as a guest professor at university for a few months, I started meeting with Christians, and with Christians that blew my mind in many, many ways. The main one I would say would be the way they would treat me, the way they would listen to me, the way they would show me how to be a different type of human being. I also met with some people that had, you know, like PhDs, and they studied a lot about language and Greek, Aramaic, Hebrew, and people like that. It was so interesting to me. All that, just long story short, led me to read the Sermon on the Mount one day. And then when I read the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, I saw three things. The first one was, when I finished reading it, I said, I'd love the world to be like this. And I'd like to be like this too. The second thing was, this Jesus claims to be God, and makes sense that God would say stuff like this. And the third was very personal, because I was very afraid of death. And Jesus claimed to have conquered death as well. So all of that, it was a huge impact on in my life. And after that, I just gave my life to Jesus, and poof, everything that I do now is all for him and through him. And I love him so much. And that is the story. Now, when I became a follower of Jesus, then I started a ministry called Ask and Wonder to bring Christians and atheists together to have conversations. I stopped doing this for a while, and now we can talk about that. Actually, it's a very interesting situation that I went through. But through that, I realized, wow, after 10 years having conversations with non-believers, Christians who are doubting, I just realized that no one ever told me I left Christianity because of Jesus. And for me, that was, wow, that should be the actual reason why you should leave Christianity. Like, that should be the one to look at Jesus and say, hey, I don't think you're true. They would look at it as a concept if they don't believe in it. So that was just very shocking to me. And that's why I decided to write this book as a novel, a story. It's very raw. It's a Christian who's losing his faith and an atheist that became a Christian, that is a friend that is helping him. And it's truly, it's like very raw, very conversation with different characters. The story moves forward in very unexpected ways, and all based in conversations that these two characters are having at a coffee shop called The Shire. It's a small thing with the Lord of the Rings. So that's what the book is about, and we can talk about it more, Spencer, of course.
You say you never heard anyone who deconstructed their faith and never reconstructed it, that it was because of Jesus. So I'll put you the question, how did that idea pop into your head? If people aren't really saying this anyway, why did that question come in?
Well, the thing, Spencer, when having conversations with many of my atheist friends is that you get to a conversation where the conversation just goes up to the sky. You start talking about concepts and philosophy and quantum physics and the ontology and all these things. Okay, do I enjoy doing that, Spencer? Yes. Do we get to the hearts of people, me and the person, as we have those conversations? No, not at all. So I just realized that many atheists do this unconsciously. And when I say many atheists, you know, when talking about things like that, I'm not doing this in order to diminish who they are, or absolutely not. It's just my experience. Many non-believers that were Christians and left the faith didn't leave the faith because of Jesus. Something happened to them. A pastor did whatever. A church member being legalistic at home. Whatever it is. And what they do, since they usually don't know how to heal that hurts, what they do is to protect it. And they do something that I call intellectual shielding, which is, I've been hurt, so what I'm going to do is to build huge walls that are going to be intellectual arguments. They're going to be protecting me so that we don't have to talk about what I'm carrying. We need to talk about these walls, and here you cannot pass through them. So I just realized that happens a lot, truly. And at one point, I just decided to bring the conversation to the ground, sharing the darkness Christ has taken me out of in my conversations, instead of talking about, you know, predestination and whatever it is, like all these things that are important, but you don't get to talk to the person. And I started asking questions to people, to the actual person. In between the words, I would hear things like behavioral patterns, or the reasons why they would wake up every morning to find more intellectual arguments to undermine something they actually know it's not true anymore. And why do they keep wrestling with something that they know it's not true anymore, but they cannot stop wrestling with it? That is just psychological pattern. There's something else beyond. I started becoming very interested about that. Those conversations didn't go that well, though. When I started bringing conversations and questions to the heart, some of them just didn't want to do it. It is okay, though. Like, I understand. Like, I'm not saying that they're bad because of that. But usually emotional reasons behind huge intellectual arguments. And for me, realizing that none of it was about Jesus broke my heart, because Jesus is there so that we can bring our doubts to him. Instead of doubting away from him, we can doubt towards him.
I really like that idea of doubting towards Jesus, because as Christians, it's not like doubting is not a cardinal sin. Like, it's okay to ask questions. It's the greatest part about God being a God of truth. Questioning is good and even encouraged. As Christians, you mentioned that, and I've heard this before too, that everyone knows God exists. And like you're saying, people that want to reject God and try to argue him away, usually it's a heart issue rather than an intellectual one. So, you know, we can be kind of miserable representatives of who Christ is. In what ways does the church need to be aware of how we are hurting our testimony and not helping, you know, encourage people to find peace in Christ?
No, that is a good question. You know, being honest with you, Spencer, it's very hard for me to generalize as the church. I would say, I'm going to tell you what I do, and hopefully this helps people. The first thing is that I would say God cannot be reduced to an argument. He wasn't supposed to be like this. Reason is amazing. I mean, it truly is. Reason helps us so much to know about God, but it lacks when it comes to knowing God. So it has, there's an experience and a relationship that is, that could be a consequence of reason. I'm not saying that, I'm not building a false dichotomy here. Both are very good, but we sometimes meet non-believers exactly where they are when it comes to arguments and when it comes to intellectual discussions. And we try to reduce God to a specific argument that is going to convince someone that life makes sense. That's just difficult. The other thing that I do is to listen super well. It took me years to learn this, but when someone is telling me whatever it is, there's so many arguments against Christianity, whatever it is, I always try to focus on the journey that took this person to say or believe what they believe, which is, for example, I don't believe God exists. Or would you tell me more about how you got to this conclusion? The question behind the question usually, not always, but usually makes them tell you more about the person behind. Oh, yeah, it was my journey, or I grew up like this. And they start telling a little bit more about who they are. And if I were to answer the question directly, oh, yeah, God exists, let me tell you this and this, Genesis, this, Romans, whatever. I do all of that. I'm missing a person. We're talking about things that are beautiful and true. But we're not talking about the person. So I'm just focusing lots about the psychology, the emotional side of people, even though apologetics and all that is very good. And there's a side for that. I think when you meet the person and you learn how to listen, the one analogy that I heard, I like it. I sometimes, Spencer, I have a hard time saying it in English because it's weird, but I think it works. So if someone comes to you or to me, Spencer, and says, Spencer, I just don't think Christianity is true anymore. That is almost like they show you, it's a silly analogy, but it's like they present you with a balloon. And they put it on the table and they're going to observe what you do with it. If you go and shoot it down directly, oh no, what is happening? No, let me tell you. Yeah, argument is that they realize it's not safe to share this with this person. It really is not. But if you let it rest there, oh yeah, tell me more. What is happening? They feel that someone really cares about listening to them. The arguments and all of that, the truth will come, absolutely. But listening to the person, that is so crucial.
I do wonder if, I mean, this is all about like rhetoric, you know, like we can't merely lay out arguments because like people put up barriers, people put up defenses and just mere reason, it's cold and it doesn't penetrate, it doesn't stick. And so like you're saying, you know, the listening is really helpful to melt their hearts, I guess, and put them a little bit more on like, okay, I can talk with this person and actually hear what they're trying to say. I wonder if maybe we just don't really believe that listening does that much, or we find it kind of a daunting task to try to carry that weight with them or something, or find a way to connect with them, I suppose. Do you think that's true? How can we do better with connecting with people?
It really is. Spencer, you know, I'm a pastor at a church called the Donaldson Fellowship. And one of the things that we're trying to do as we disciple people is being so good for us, for all of us to be so humble is, you know, when someone is opening up about their issues, the tendency for us is always to give our opinion, which is, oh, let me tell you, this happened to me, or I know this, or all that. And we're trying to train ourselves to bring them to the Lord, to hold our mouths, and just to bring them to the Lord. Because what can I say that is going to really, right? Like, I mean, I can be there, of course. But the first thing I should do is to bring them to the Lord. A person that is, you know, struggling with their faith, they might need space away from the Lord for a second to just for someone to listen so that they don't feel that they're being judged because they are doubting their faith. It's a different situation. But again, listening, you said it really well. We think that listening doesn't do anything. And how many people, Spencer, that you and I know would change dramatically if they had someone willing to just sit down and listen to them without trying to fix them. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Well, my guest today is Pedro Garcia. He's the author of For Those Who Doubt, Is It Because of Jesus? Conversations for Those Deconstructing Their Faith. For this book that you're writing about, and you examine a lot of topics, I'm sure, you wrote it as a dialogue rather than just, yeah, you know, straight prose, but it's a sort of this narrative. Why did you write it that way?
Well, a few reasons. So the first one is that I realized, Spencer, that I have many Christian friends that haven't had a conversation with a non-believer ever. They just haven't. They don't have experiences with talking to people with different worldviews. And I thought, well, this is a way to invite Christians to be a part of this table at the Shire, the coffee shop where everything is happening. So they're almost like sitting at the table with the characters. They can be at a different table listening to them because the narrator in the book is describing everything in present tense. So it's almost like you're reading a script, to be honest with you. But it's in the present tense, so you feel that it's happening, you're there. Also, when it comes to dialogue, I try to do it like that because I wrote this book not as a story, but almost like topics. And I gave it to a few friends and they told me, Pedro, this book is absolutely horrendous. And I said, that is amazing. Thank you so much for the feedback. But then I had an agnostic friend that read and said, Pedro, this book, you could write all of this, but into a story. I got so excited. Because really, with a story, you're not telling people, hey, this is Christianity, this is the argument, this is the... You're dropping a person into a world. Boom. And all of a sudden, they're just looking around. They need to figure something out. Now, the conversation aspects of them of it also shows that people are not only arguments. Because I wanted to show that people are emotions, both Christians and non-Christians. We're so many things. Beyond, oh yeah, the ontological argument for the existence of God. Yeah, but you need to go home and eat and rest and you sneeze and yawn and you're a person. And then you go to bed. You go to bed scared because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Uncertainty, the people that you love dying. I mean, you need to show that. So I really showed all of that in the book. At the end of the book, I try because I wrote the book for Christians who are doubting, but I'm realizing after I published, there are non-believers reading it, there are Christians reading it, but I wrote it so that the Christians who is doubting gets to the end of the book and faces the question themselves. Is it because of Jesus? So that hopefully they will go, wow, no, it's not because of Jesus, which means complete transformation and opportunity to refresh their relationship with Jesus in the most dramatic and beautiful way. When people read the book or you talk about the book, you go, oh, this is a book on apologetics. Apologetics, I would say, is the first coat of paint in the book. Absolutely. There are many things, conversations between an atheist person, there's Thomas who's losing his faith, Peter, the atheist that became Christian, and there are all many characters having all these deep conversations, faith and science, theology, Jesus, and social justice issues, make so many things. But through it, I'm showing Christians saying things they're not supposed to say or behaving in ways that they're not supposed to behave. The same with non-believers, atheists, showing the side of us that is very, you know, like we're imperfect beings. So I'm showing all of that in very raw ways to let people know that it's Jesus. It's just not, you know, he's the one.
Yeah, what sort of topics do you address? You talked about a few there, yeah. And how do you address them?
Yeah, so through the conversation, the characters and things that happen to them, the God of the Old Testament, slavery, faith and science, creation itself, social justice issues, abortion, homosexuality, the redefinition of sexuality, and... yeah, many arguments for and against the existence of God. There's a lot in the book. Like, it's very exhaustive. Now, people shouldn't expect a book that is, all of this is told through story, so they shouldn't expect to have a peer-reviewed article on the ontological, because there's no time in a story to do that. And actually, I couldn't write that because I don't have the knowledge to get to that point. So it's more all, it's happening in the conversations. The barista, my favorite character in the book, the barista shows up and, hey, the coffee's here. What's happening? So all of that is happening through the story. And so, yeah, all these topics are presented, I would say, with very, very compelling arguments for Christianity. Absolutely. But there are other moments where Christians do things, say things that they shouldn't or say or do, and all the moments where non-believers lose it completely and do things they're not supposed to do either. And it's kind of, it's a raw book.
So for the person, for the Christian who is experiencing like pretty serious doubts and is deconstructing and it needs, you know, to some rebuilding, how would you encourage him or her to doubt well and find Christ as a guide and a shepherd in the midst of that?
Amen. Amen. You said it really well at the beginning of this conversation. We treat doubt as if it were a sin or like it's bad. And there's so many people in scripture, like the last prophet of the old covenant, John the Baptist, doubted. And he was in jail, sent his disciples to Jesus. It's so interesting what Jesus does. Hey, see, quoting Isaiah, I think it is, the deaf can hear and the blind can see. So go tell him, I'm the one that was supposed to come. And apparently Jesus is having a conversation with a group of people at that moment. John the Baptist is great, you know? And you go, really? Like after doubting. And I think the key is what we said, Spencer, you can doubt toward Jesus or you can doubt away from him. It's just a key. I mean, there's so many, when someone doubts, this person should immediately acknowledge, oh, I'm part of a long-standing 2,000-year tradition. Like, I'm not new. So many people have doubted Abraham, Moses, prophets, and I mean, everyone, every single one. Elisha asking people, kill me now. Like, it's just, so doubting is nothing new without doubting. Now, what I would say, Spencer, is the motivation. Because many people, something happens to them that hurts them. And they go, now I have a reason to deconstruct. But what happens is that the motivation is, I am going to deconstruct with the hope that I leave Christianity. But that is not neutral, deconstructing. The motivation is to leave. So what you do is just to reassure yourself that what you're doing is going to take you where you want to go already. The actual deconstruction is a neutral standing point where you go, I want to make sure that all of this is true. What is going to happen? You go and you, oh, this belief, oh, my parents were legalistic. I don't understand what love is because love feels like something I need to earn all the time. That is not Jesus. Okay, boom. This and that and that. At the end, you go, boom, I am a Christian. I'm closer to truth now. It could be that some people do it and, oh, wow, look, I don't believe in any of this. I'm not a Christian anymore. But many people start the construction with the goal in mind. That happens so many times. So I would ask people to be super honest as they do it.
From the other side, again, I guess going back to the, you know, the whole topic of conversation we had earlier about listening to people's hearts. For us who are hearing friends, family members, you know, their faith is falling apart and they are experiencing serious doubts and these sorts of hard issues maybe that is hurtful. And they're kind of eyeing, maybe I want to exit the church and I don't want to be a Christian anymore. That can be scary. I suspect many of us hearing that would probably freak out. We wouldn't know what to say or how to listen. How do we prepare ourselves, would you say, from, you know, things you've observed, to hear people's hearts and like the weighty burdens that is causing the deconstruction?
Yeah, it's quite scary because at the psychological level, when someone that you love tells you, I don't believe Christianity is true anymore, something that we do, it has a name. I don't remember the name in psychology. Some type of cognitive dissonance, maybe. What happens is that we merge the belief with the person. So if the person that you love says, I don't think Christianity is true anymore, all of a sudden your brain panics and you start not seeing the person that you loved. You're trying to figure out this new person that is in front of you. And I understand. I really understand. All that process is scary. But the Lord uses moments like that all the time to renew people's faiths. Like, he really does. And at the end of the day, we're not in control of people's faiths either. Like, we're really not. So I would say, in order to prepare for that, is things like negative theology, meaning what people say, we cannot say what God is, but only what God is not. So bringing that idea, I'm not saying that that is true. I'm just saying this as an analogy. Things I would say not to do is, don't try to sound smart. Don't do that. Someone is breaking in front of you. Don't try to sound smart. Don't try to fix the person in the moment. Pray for that person as a potential Christian. Always stop seeing non-believers and atheists as atheists. They are potential Christians in God's economy. And trust that the Spirit knows how to lead conversations in such a way that the things that need to be said are going to be said in its own right time.
You've been listening to His People on Pilgrim Radio. Many thanks to today's guest, Pedro Garcia, author of For Those Who Doubt, Is It Because of Jesus? He's a native of Spain and a translator for the Bible Project and GodQuestions.org. On tomorrow's program, J. Alistair Groves on how to understand and nurture healthy biblical emotions.
The most important thing you could ever have is to feel the way you want to feel. And the pursuit of, I just want to feel authentic, or I want to feel okay, or I want to do what feels right to me. Those would be the driving instincts of our culture's ethics. You need to feel the way you want to feel. And I think that is wildly unbiblical.
That's tomorrow at the same time right here on His People. Thanks for listening.